provide security, especially for the elderly. This building wasn't huge, but Dell estimated it contained at least 12 different units. He pushed a button, waited. A male voice answered, and Dell asked for Andrea Gonzalez.
You have the wrong apartment.
I'm sorry. I must have written it down wrong. Do you happen to know her apartment number?
No, sorry.
Dell tried another apartment but got no answer. He pushed buttons for a third and then a fourth apartment. The tenants who answered either didn't know Gonzalez or hesitated enough for Dell to know they weren't about to give out her apartment to a stranger, even if they knew it. He tried several more but either got no answer or no information. Frustrated, he stepped back to the walk, feeling just the hint of a breeze on his neck, trying to focus, coming up with nothing. He called Faz's cell phone once again, and again it went to voicemail. He swore under his breath as he made his way back to the Impala. Inside his car, he called into the night shift and asked for Ron Mayweather.
I need you to fill out a form to get the last known longitude and latitude for Faz's cell phone.
What's going on, Dell?
I don't know. He isn't home, and he isn't at work, and he isn't answering his cell. Can you run it down?
Yeah, I'm on it. I'll call you as soon as I hear anything.
51. Sam Mukherjee stood in the cul-de-sac of his family's home, staring somberly at Kins and Tracy. He wore a helmet, t-shirt, and shorts, and held one end of a skateboard, the other end beneath his tennis shoe. Tracy pushed out of the car door and approached.
Hey, Sam.
Sam flipped the board and caught it.
Hey.
He sounded and looked uncertain.
My parents aren't home.
Do you know where they are? Tracy asked.
My father's out making arrangements for Kavita's funeral, I think. My mother went for a walk and hasn't come back.
His chin tilted up as if to consider the darkening night sky. Crickets clicked, a chorus coming from the park.
Do you know where she walked? Tracy asked.
Sam pointed over his shoulder to the trees.
She usually walks in the park, but she's also usually home by now, so...
Every night? Tracy said.
Pretty much, Sam said. Sometimes my dad goes with her, but not always.
And your brother, Nikhil, where is he?
Kins asked.
He's inside. Sam gestured vaguely. I don't know what he's doing.
Do you have your phone on you, Sam? Tracy asked. Sam pointed to a shirt on the concrete steps of the narrow porch.
Yeah, he said, tentatively.
I'm going to need to take it, Sam.
Why?
Tracy did not want to blow up the young boy's world, but that was inevitable now.
Your mother said she takes your phone at night. Is that right?
Yeah, usually, but she isn't here and it's summer, so she hasn't been taking it. Sometimes she forgets. I think with everything that has happened.
Why do you want it?
Did you give your mother your phone Monday night? Tracy asked. He shook his head.
No, I had a soccer game and stayed at my friend's.
But you sent Kavita a text Monday night, right?
Yeah, I was worried about her. I heard my mom and dad talking about Aditi getting married in India. My mom was upset about it. I knew Vita would be upset, too. I just wanted to find out how she was doing, if she was okay.
And she told you she couldn't go to your game because she had a date, didn't she?
Yeah.
Did she tell you about other times she'd had dates?
Yeah.
More than once?
Couple of times, I think.
And these were text messages?
Usually. Sometimes I called her.
Tracy looked to Kins. They'd discussed the likelihood that if Kavita had told Sam about one date, they'd discussed others, and that information would have been readily available on the boy's phone.
Did you ever track your sister's cell phone, Sam?
What?
His confusion sounded sincere.
Did you ever track Kavita's cell phone to determine where she was?
I wouldn't even know how you'd do that. I mean, maybe I would, I guess, but I didn't ever do that. Why would I?
Do you know, Sam, if your parents read the text messages you shared with Kavita?
He shook his head, emphatic. I deleted those. What about your other messages to friends? Did your parents read those?
My mom did. Sometimes, I mean. It was kind of BS, you know, but she said that since they were paying for my phone, I didn't really have a choice.
You're on your parents' cell phone account, right?
Uh-huh.
Did your parents put any parental safeguards on your phone? Safeguards that allowed them to read your text messages? Even the ones you might have deleted?
Sam was about to respond, but then paused, as if a thought had come to him and it had taken the words out of his mouth. His eyes lost focus and his gaze dipped to the ground. When he re-engaged with Tracy, he'd figured out that answer, just as Tracy had figured it out, though he did not yet know the full consequences. Andrei Vilkotsky had confirmed what Tracy suspected as she and Kins drove from the airport to Bellevue. She'd called him and asked him about apps parents could use to read their children's phone messages, even without having the phone. Vilkotsky had said that the number of spyware apps that allowed parents to read their children's emails and text messages, even those texts and messages the child thought he had deleted, were too numerous to list. Vilkotsky had also confirmed that because Sam shared an Apple account with his sister, his parents could also use his telephone number to track Kavita's cell phone. So if Sam and Kavita had discussed Kavita dating, then his mother had also known, for some time, and she'd had the ability to track Kavita's phone to determine where she'd been. If she had done so, she would have determined a routine. Kavita's and Dr. Charles Shea's routine, every Monday night, ending in a hotel room in Kirkland.
"I'll handle the older brother," Kin said, moving toward the front door.
"Can you handle the mother?" 52. Foz opened his eyes, or thought he did. The room remained dark. It took another moment for his other senses to come online. When they did, he wished they hadn't. His head pounded, deep, agonizing thumps that beat with his pulse. He realized he was only seeing out of his right eye. His left eye had swollen nearly shut, his field of vision just a slit. When he attempted to sit up, to relieve the pressure of the handcuffs cutting into his wrists, he winced and grimaced from the pain in his ribs, bad enough that he almost cried out. He had to move in stages, mentally preparing himself for the pain before each movement. His shoulders and arms ached where boots and fists had pummeled him, and his ribs burned as though on fire. He was having difficulty catching his breath. Each time he inhaled, it brought a searing pain in his side and caused him to cough, which only further intensified that pain. He lowered his head to his hands and explored his face. His fingers touched warm, sticky fluid trickling from his head, down his neck, and behind his ears. Blood. A lot of it. Little Jimmy and his minions had beaten Foz like a piñata. He tasted the iron flavor in his mouth, his tongue exploring the insides of his cheeks for cuts and broken teeth. After his quick physical assessment, he went to work on his surroundings and his circumstances. He remained handcuffed to the pipe in the room, and, for all intents and purposes, he was seriously screwed. The beating, however, had worse implications than the physical damage. It indicated little Jimmy really didn't care whether Foz lived or died. In fact, the beating indicated that Foz's bluff of a police firestorm if they killed him hadn't worked. Little Jimmy was more concerned with losing tens of millions of dollars of the cartel's product. The cartel would kill Little Jimmy if that happened, which meant Jimmy had no other option but to kill Foz. Foz realized that he'd been stupid. He should have insisted that his presence was only related to his investigation into the death of Monique Rogers. Instead, he'd given Little Jimmy another reason to kill him, as if Jimmy needed another reason. Foz thought of Vera, about leaving her alone to face her cancer, and felt a profound sadness sweep over him and tears pool in his eyes. The sound of men's voices outside the room and keys in the lock focused his thoughts. The overhead fluorescent lights flipped on, sharp and painful, like shards of glass in his eyes. He tilted his head so he could look up through his one good eye.
"Detective Fatso, you look like shit, man."
Little Jimmy crouched and grabbed Foz's face, producing a searing pain where his fingers dug into the flesh.
He turned Faz's jaw so he could look at him.
So, detective, you feel like talking, or do you want to tell some more jokes?
No point, Jimmy, he mumbled. My jokes are obviously over this crowd's head.
Then you feel like telling me what you're doing here?
I told you. I came here looking for you, Faz said, his voice barely a whisper. And my partner knows that I did.
There was no sense changing the story now. Little Jimmy smiled.
And you found me. I guess that's why you're a detective, huh?
But I told you. I checked your phone, and I don't think your phone lies. Entiende? I don't think you told anyone why you're here. You're alone. You're on an island.
You said that. You need another metaphor.
Jimmy paused.
I need a what?
My luck, I'm stuck on the island with you, Faz whispered.
You got me thinking, Gabrun. You got me wondering why you're here and why you would have come alone. So I had to check the videotape, you know, to see if maybe you were following someone.
Faz felt his stomach grip. Little Jimmy stood and nodded to the door. Hector, steroid boy, and the third man dragged a body into the room, but the head dangled so Faz could not see his face, though he had a pretty good idea who he was. They dumped the body at Little Jimmy's feet. Jimmy used his boot to roll the man onto his back. Faz had to tilt his head to see. He recognized Francisco, though barely. Francisco's face was swollen and caked with dried blood. His nose shot off at a right angle, and he looked like he had a golf ball beneath his left eye.
You see, detective, I'm like a plumber. I'm always looking for leaks. And I think maybe I found one.
Never saw him before, Faz said.
But you see, it's like I said. The tape don't lie.
Did you say that?
I don't recall.
You're going to tell me why you followed Francisco. Why you took pictures at the fairgrounds. And who's the woman he was talking to, hmm?
Faz had forgotten about the grainy and unfocused photographs he'd snapped at the outdoor fair before he'd been bumped. He took a moment and came to another realization. Little Jimmy needed information, and that just might be the one thing to keep Faz alive, at least for the short term. Despite all of his bravado, Little Jimmy was scared. He knew the consequences if he screwed up the cartel shipment. In the end, he was just as Faz had believed, another punk.
I don't know what you're talking about, Faz said.
Little Jimmy lifted Faz's head by the hair, yanking it back so Faz could see him. A sharp pain radiated across his scalp and down the back of his neck. Jimmy crouched, eye to eye.
Do you think I'm stupid, detective? Oh, how Faz wanted to answer that question.
Instead, he said,
I was coming back to Eduardo Lopez's apartment and I saw him on the street. So I followed him.
Really?
What, you follow all us Mexicans now? I think they call that racial profiling, detective. I think it's illegal. I'm going to have to call my lawyer.
Faz wasn't sure what to say, though he knew not to say he'd seen the man, Francisco, at Eduardo Lopez's apartment.
I recognized him from the party at your house.
That answer seemed to catch Little Jimmy off guard. He smiled, like a cat before eating the mouse.
And you remembered him. What, you gringos think all us Mexicans look alike?
Jimmy lost his smile.
You're a terrible liar. Francisco wasn't at my party. Francisco was at home with his wife and kids.
I guess I was wrong. You all do look alike.
Jimmy pulled something from his pocket, a cell phone, though it didn't belong to Faz.
I don't know who Francisco has been texting. But I think maybe it's you. So I check your phone. But no, he's not texting you.
So who's Francisco texting, cabrón? Hmm? Who's he texting?
Maybe he's having an affair, Faz said, and didn't want his wife to know.
Jimmy stepped back, reached behind his waist, and pulled out a handgun, a shiny silver piece that looked like a small cannon.
Hold him up, he said. gesturing for the others to lift Francisco from the ground. Foz figured this was it. He was going to die in the back room of a storage facility and likely end up dumped in some body of water with weights around his legs. Vera would never know what had happened to him. Shit. He wondered if Vera would even have the cancer surgery if Foz died. Foz wasn't sure he'd want to go on living without her. Hector and the other man lifted Francisco under his arms to a more or less kneeling position. His head flopped between his shoulders. Jimmy put the barrel of the gun to the back of Francisco's head.
I'm going to ask you one more time, detective. You tell me a joke or you say I don't know, and I'm going to blow off the back of Francisco's head. And then his death is going to be on your conscience, just like my father's. So I'm going to ask you again, and if you don't tell me, I'm going to kill Francisco. Then I'm going to kill you, grind you up, and feed you to the pigs.
Little Jimmy stepped back and racked a bullet into the chamber of the silver pistol. He again pressed the barrel to the back of Francisco's head.
So, last chance, cabrón. Who is he texting?
53. The park held a quiet tranquility, the way the North Cascades had once felt when Tracy had been a young girl and walked through them early on weekend mornings. Tracy's father had told her that people referred to grottos of trees as God's cathedrals. She understood why. Mornings, when the sun streamed between the trunks, the shafts of light looked like descending angels. Not tonight. Tonight, the remnants of light colored the park in muted grays. No angels here, not in this place, which would be forever marked by evil. Tracy followed the same trail she'd taken the night she and Pryor ventured into the park, though this time without the blinking blue light to guide her, or the ominous feeling that she was about to stumble onto something horrific. Tonight she knew the way, and she had a different sense of horror, one that she continued to chastise herself for not seeing sooner. Praniv and Sam had not been home Monday night, nor had his parents, not until late. Only Himani and Nikhil had been present. Tracy veered to her right at the first fork in the road and continued along the outer trail. Bullfrogs croaked, as if alerting one another to her presence. She slowed her pace as she approached the path leading to the hole in the ground, though the hole had since been filled in by the park ranger. The trail crested. Tracy stopped atop that knoll, looking down upon the person standing at the edge of where the hole had once been. Himani Mukherjee looked very much like a penitent at what would forever be a gravesite in one of God's cathedrals. As if sensing Tracy's presence, or perhaps expecting it, Himani lifted her gaze and turned, but her glance was brief. She let her eyes drift back to her daughter's grave. Tracy had been thinking of a number of things to say, but now that she had arrived, she didn't feel the need to say anything. She stepped forward and stood at the edge of where the hole had been and waited nearly a full minute before Himani finally spoke.
"I don't expect you to understand, detective."
Her voice barely carried over the sounds of the forest. And on that point, Himani was correct. Tracy did not understand. "Why don't you try and explain it to me?" she said. Himani smiled, though it had a forlorn and defeated appearance.
"What would be the point?" she said.
"Closure," she said. "That's why you're here, isn't it? Looking for closure? Was there a reason?"
"There were many reasons," Himani said, recovering some of her anger and bitterness that Tracy first had detected the night she went to the Mukherjee home.
Then it was gone again. Himani exhaled and the air shuddered in her chest, but she did not allow herself to cry.
"Many reasons to be upset with Kavita," she said softly, as if speaking to herself.
Tracy waited.
"She disrespected her family. She disrespected herself. She embarrassed us in front of all our relatives and friends. At first, her father and I agreed that it would be best to just wait for her to come to her senses. We figured that, in time, she would come home. that she would ask me to find her a suitable husband. And if that didn't work, we thought a more practical reason would bring her home.
She'd run out of money, Tracy said.
But she didn't come home, and she didn't run out of money. And you began to wonder why not.
Even when Aditi returned from India married, Kavita still refused. She became even more defiant.
You and Kavita seem very much alike in that regard, Tracy said.
Himani glanced at Tracy, the same look she'd given Sam when he'd confessed that he and Kavita had exchanged text messages.
You don't understand. You don't understand what it feels like to know that your daughter is a whore. I know about hotel rooms, detective, and about the man she met there. I know why she didn't run out of money, and why she didn't need to come home.
She turned and stared at Tracy, and Tracy couldn't help but think again of that word, defiant. Himani's voice hardened.
You didn't have to listen to Aditi's parents go on about Aditi and Rashesh and the money his family has, about the beautiful home in London where they would live, and about all the grandchildren they will soon have.
She shook her head, the anger in her voice continuing to build.
You do not understand the humiliation.
She spoke the last words through gritted teeth. Then she closed her eyes and her nostrils flared, and her breathing became heavy. She gave Tracy a dismissive wave, like she was just a nuisance.
You don't understand. Our ways are not your ways.
When did you realize you could follow Kavita using Sam's phone? Tracy didn't believe Himani had learned this on her own. She believed she learned from someone younger, someone more familiar with technology.
Nikhil.
Himani shrugged, just a small acknowledgement.
I've monitored Sam's text messages since we bought him the phone, and I've tracked his phone to see where he goes. Tracking Vita's phone was not difficult.
So you saw the text Sam sent Kavita Monday night?
And Vita's reply, she said. It was just another of many messages, Detective, and always on a Monday night.
It confirmed that Himani had detected Kavita's routine with Shay. For a long moment, Himani did not speak, and Tracy thought that perhaps she would choose not to say anything more. Then she said,
I had just left the Desguptas' home. They had a party for their friends who could not go to the wedding in India. Kavita was not there, though I was not surprised. I had to listen to them brag about Aditi and about their new son-in-law.
Pranav was gone, traveling. He did not have to listen to it. She raised her hands and curled her fingers into her hair as if to hold her skull together.
Their voices rang in my ears like splinters of glass. By the time I got home, my head was pounding.
She gave a wistful sigh.
I went onto my computer and I pulled up the app. And I saw the messages between Sam and Kavita.
Himani looked at Tracy.
Even on the day Kavita learned Aditi had married, Kavita refused to change her behavior. She continued to humiliate us. It was like she took joy in twisting the knife in our backs.
She wasn't going to continue seeing him, Tracy said. She'd told him she was through. She was moving on. She was going to attend medical school. This seemed to give Himani pause, but only briefly.
It doesn't change what she had become, Himani said.
It doesn't change the fact that she had defiled herself, and no self-respecting man would have her.
Tracy looked at the disturbed soil, bits of broken branches and bruised and battered leaves atop the dirt. Then she looked back to Himani, watching her carefully. Waiting for her to continue. When she did not, Tracy said,
Did you send Nikhil to the hotel, intending that he kill Kavita?
54. Kins told Sam to wait outside and not to enter the house. Then Kins went inside. The lights were off, the house quiet. He removed his Glock, holding it at his thigh.
Nikhil, he called out.
It's Detective Kensington Rowe from the Seattle Police Department. I'd like to talk to you.
No answer.
Nikhil? Kins said again as he stepped from the foyer into the living room.
The grandmother and grandfather were seated there. They looked at him with a quiet terror.
"Where's Nikhil?" he asked.
The grandfather's eyes shifted to the kitchen, but he did not speak. Kins and Tracy had discussed the possible scenarios on the drive from the airport to Bellevue and agreed that Himani could not have carried Kavita to the hole alone. So either Himani had killed Kavita and then enlisted Nikhil's help hiding her body, or Nikhil had killed his sister. Kins moved across the foyer and dining room and stepped slowly to the doorway. He peered into the kitchen. Nikhil sat at the table in the far corner with the lights off, but Kins could see the large kitchen knife, the point pressing against the young man's throat. Kins took a moment to regain his composure. He spoke calmly.
"Nikhil, put the knife down."
Nikhil's eyes found Kins, but he did not respond. Kins slowly stepped into the room, struggling with what to say. He thought of his three boys, how close they were.
"Your brother's outside," he said, "and your grandparents are in the other room. You don't want them to see this."
"Sam hates me,"
Nikhil said, voice nearly a whisper.
"No," Kins said. "Sam doesn't hate you."
The blade moved up and down each time Nikhil swallowed or spoke.
"Sam loved Vita."
"Yes, he did. But you're his only brother, Nikhil. He's already lost his sister. Don't let him lose his brother."
"He won't care what happens to me."
Kins kept his gun at his side and stood a safe distance from the table.
"He will care. No matter what has happened, you'll always be his brother. Don't do this to him. Don't do this to your parents and your grandparents. Put the knife down." Nikhil did not comply.
"Then tell me what it is you want, Nikhil." Kins wanted to keep the young man talking.
"What I want?"
"Yes, tell me what you want."
"Why did you have to do it?"
he said. Tears streamed down his cheeks.
"Why couldn't she come home, get married? Was it so bad?"
"I don't know, Nikhil."
"Do you know what she did? She disgraced all of us."
"Maybe she did, Nikhil. But killing yourself is not going to change anything now. It's only going to make things worse.
Your brother has already lost a sister, and your parents have lost a daughter. Don't make them bury a brother and a son, too."
"Baba will wish I was dead," he said.
"No, he won't. No matter what you've done, he will always be your father." "You know how I know that?" Nikhil made eye contact. His eyes at least appeared hopeful, like he wanted the answer, wanted to know that his father would always love him. "Because I have three sons of my own, and they'll always be my sons, no matter what they've done. No matter how bad it might be, I'll always be their father and they will always be my sons."
"You must be a good father, detective."
"So is your father. He'll want to help you, Nikhil. Don't hurt him this way. Don't make him bury two children. Put the knife down, son. Let's all sit down and discuss this."
"What is there to discuss, detective?"
"We can discuss what happened and why. Don't you want to tell me why?"
"I don't know why, it just happened."
"There are people you can talk to, people who can help you understand why. I'm sure you must have been very upset about what was happening. I'm sure your sister made you angry. I'm sure you weren't thinking clearly."
Kins noticed a thin red line, then a trickle of blood down the side of Nikhil's neck.
"Let me get you some help, Nikhil. There are people who can help you. They can help you to better understand what happened."
"I understand what happened, detective, and I know what I did."
"Nikhil?"
Kins turned his head at the sound of Sam's voice. The young boy stood in the kitchen doorway.
"Stay out, Sam," Kins said.
"What are you doing?"
"Leave, Sam," Nikhil said. Sam stepped in.
"What are you doing? Put that knife down."
"Leave," Nikhil said more forcefully. "Sam, stay where you are," Kins said. Then again, more slowly. "Just stay where you are. Everyone just take a deep breath and let's all stay calm.
Get him out of here, Nikhil said, his voice harsh and agitated.
Sam took a step forward.
Put the knife down. You're cut. You're bleeding.
Get him out, detective.
Sam, your brother wants you to leave.
Put the knife down, Nikhil.
You don't know what I've done, Sam. You don't know.
Put the knife down.
I'm sorry, Sam, Nikhil said. I'm so sorry.
55. Foz didn't have a lot of sympathy for a gang member and likely drug dealer, but he also didn't want to be the reason Francisco died. He knew, too, because little Jimmy had been stupid enough to tell him, that Francisco had texted someone, and that someone had to have been Gonzalez. If he was right, the longer he could stall, the better chances of their survival. Others in the room were talking to little Jimmy in animated Spanish, and it didn't take a rocket scientist to deduce that they were telling him they needed to leave, quickly. Little Jimmy, however, was blinded by his hatred of Foz. Foz pulled himself up, swallowing the pain.
You know what, Jimmy? I actually liked your old man.
Little Jimmy turned his gaze to Foz, perhaps waiting for the punchline. He kept the barrel of the gun pointed at the back of Francisco's head.
I didn't agree with what he did, but he had his priorities in the right place. He took care of his family, and he took care of his community. Under different circumstances, he might have been a politician, and a good one.
He smiled. Jimmy looked perplexed, confused, hopefully not more pissed off. The man at the back of the room interrupted, his voice and his actions more animated.
Tenemos que irnos ahora, Jimmy. Todavía tenemos tiempo.
You know why?
You want to know why they killed him?
Foz said, drawing Jimmy's attention back to him.
They killed him because they knew he was his own man, that he did things his own way, that he cared about his people. Nobody told Big Jimmy what to do, not even his cartel. That's why they killed him. You know what else? He never let his emotions color his decisions. That's why he was such a good businessman. But what about you? What would your father think of you? What would Big Jimmy think of you right now?
Little Jimmy didn't answer, but Foz had his attention. It was one thing to say that the cartel did not respect him. It was another to say his father would not respect him.
Maybe I won't be the one putting the cuffs on your wrists, but kill me and I'm still going to be the reason they nail your ass. They're going to come after you, Jimmy. You know they will. You're letting your emotions make decisions for you. You think my partner is going to let this rest ever? He's Sicilian. Kill me and he's going to make it his life's mission to bring you down. You're not going to be able to take a shit without him being there to watch you wipe your ass. You think you're going to go back to Mexico and live like a king? Think again. How do you think your pals in Mexico are going to like you when they find out you have a detective on your ass 24/7 because you killed a cop? You're going to become a liability. And you know what they do to liabilities? Foz smiled. So if Del doesn't kill you?
He looked at the others.
All of you. They will. You going to feed me to the pigs? Those pigs won't even sniff me after they've eaten all of you.
Jimmy redirected the gun at Foz, but Foz could see that he was having misgivings. The others, too, had misgivings about killing him, about the ramifications if Jimmy did so.
Jimmy, no, Hector said. Shut up. We have to go, now, Hector said.
Another man stepped into the office speaking clipped Spanish. Though Foz could not understand what he'd said, he could tell it was urgent, that something was happening. The others also urged little Jimmy to move. Hector grabbed his arm. Jimmy looked at Foz. Hector continued to pull on him. The man at the door yelled Jimmy's name. Whatever was happening, it was reaching a critical stage. Jimmy grunted, swore, then turned and hurried out the door. Foz exhaled a slow breath, but this was not the time to get cocky. He considered Francisco.
Hey, are you conscious? Hey, can you hear me?
Francisco slowly turned his head.
Did you understand what the man at the door just said?
Francisco spoke in a whisper.
The trucks are here. The drugs are being loaded for shipment. They need to leave.
his head again slumped.
Who did you text?
Foz asked.
Hey, who did you text?
Foz heard sounds outside, men yelling in both English and Spanish, just before their voices were drowned out by the thumping of helicopter blades slicing the stagnant air. A powerful beam of light pierced the window of the outer office, and slatted shadows undulated on the adjacent wall. 56. Himani raised her head, but her eyes remained focused on the grave.
Nikhil had nothing to do with this, she said.
Then tell me what you did, Tracy said, not believing her, but wanting to lock down whatever story Himani chose to tell.
I don't remember what I did, detective. I just recall Vita falling to the ground, not moving.
Himani reached up and touched her head.
She had blood on the side of her head where I hit her. I remember blood on the rock and on my hands. I dropped it, somewhere in the bushes.
She held out her arm in a dismissive gesture.
What did you do next? I wanted to run from the park, into the street to get help, but...
She was lying. She didn't act alone. Nikhil had been there.
How did you carry the body? Tracy asked.
Another shrug.
I don't know how. I just did.
Tracy did not doubt Himani knew of the hole, possibly from one of her nightly walks, but she did doubt that Himani had carried Kavita's body by herself. It was far more likely she sent Nikhil to bring his sister home, that she had told Nikhil what his sister had become, and he had followed Kavita from the hotel and killed her in the park. In his panic, he'd run to his mother, and she had worked to protect her son. It didn't explain why Kavita had come to the park. That was a question to which they might never know the answer. Kaylee Wright would determine whether any of the imprints around the hole in the ground matched Nikhil's shoes or maybe his mother's.
I didn't expect you to find her, Himani continued. When you came to our home and said you had traced her phone, I knew it was just a matter of time.
Did you or Nikhil take her burner phone? Tracy asked. Himani turned and looked at Tracy.
I've lost a daughter, detective. I won't lose a son.
Maybe not, Tracy thought, though that would be determined in time.
You can't protect him, she shrugged. We shall see what I can do.
So be it. Turn around, Tracy said, removing the handcuffs from her belt.
I'm going to handcuff you. Then I'm going to read you your rights. You see, detective, I was right, Himani said.
Really? About what?
You don't understand. You don't understand because you're not a mother.
Not yet, she said. And never like you. 57. Kins was about to rush for the knife when Sam spoke again.
Put down the knife, Nikhil, please.
Tears streamed down Nikhil's face. Kins watched the knife, watched to see whether the blade drew more blood. Nikhil's arm collapsed, as if he had been holding a heavy weight and could no longer bear the burden. The knife clattered onto the table and fell to the floor. Sam moved to his brother. Kins stepped forward and kicked away the knife. He didn't know if Nikhil was crying for what he had done or because he had been caught. The two were not the same. Regardless, he believed Kelly Rosa was correct, that the killing had been one born of anger. He waited, letting the brothers have a moment together, suspecting that it would be one they would not likely have again. Not for a very long time, if ever. 58. Foz watched heavily armed men in Kevlar vests burst into the building and clear the rooms.
Here,
Foz called out. They entered the room in precision movements. Once satisfied the room was clear, they moved to where Francisco lay on the floor and Foz sat with his arms cuffed to the pole.
He's in bad shape, Foz said to the first man to enter. Take care of him first. Are you Detective Fazio?
Foz nodded.
Yeah.
Dell stepped into the outer room, and when he saw Foz, he seemed to give a sigh of relief, though he had the same look of horror he'd had the night he stepped off the elevator at Eduardo Lopez's apartment building. He crossed the room quickly.
"We got help coming," Dell said.
For once, Foz could not think of anything to say. He nodded. After a moment, he said,
"Don't tell Vera I'm hurt. She'll worry."
"I don't think she's going to buy it, Foz."
"Pretty bad, huh?"
"Pretty bad. I don't want her to see me. Not like this, Dell. You know Vera. Wild horses wouldn't keep her away."
"Then get me cleaned up. At least get me cleaned up."
"We will, Foz. We got an ambulance coming."
"How did you find me?" Foz asked.
"Too much to explain at the moment," Dell said.
He put an arm around his partner's shoulders and pulled him close.
"Hey, you know how you've always said you have a face only a mother could love?" "Not so sure anymore."
Foz smiled.
"Don't make me laugh. It hurts too much."
Paramedics took Foz from the building on a stretcher. The area outside looked like a military zone. Little Jimmy and the rest of his minions lay face down on the pavement, hands cuffed behind their backs. Around them, men and women in body armor and fatigues stood guard. Overhead, a helicopter continued to hover, the thumping of its blades deafening, a bright light shining down on the mini-storage facility. More men and women stood near the chain-link fence and the storage units. They seemed to be waiting for someone to give them the word to enter and begin their search, which meant they were waiting for a signed search warrant. As the stretcher passed Little Jimmy, he looked up from the ground and made eye contact with Foz. Foz smiled, then he raised his hand, made a gun with his thumb and index finger, and squeezed the trigger, miming the recoil. Little Jimmy looked away. The medics slid Foz into the back of the ambulance. Dell stood outside talking to Vera on his cell phone. He mouthed the word Vera to Foz, who nodded. Dell held the phone up to Foz's ear while the paramedic slipped a cuff over Foz's bicep and inflated it to check his blood pressure.
"Hey, Vera," Foz said, struggling to speak in a full voice.
"Vic, are you all right?"
Yeah, I'm all right. I got a few cuts and bruises, but they're taking good care of me. Don't worry about me."
Vera was crying.
"Seriously, I'm fine, honey."
Vera was having none of it.
"I'll meet you at the hospital," she said. "Have Dell call me when you're on your way."
"Yeah, okay," he said. "I'll have him do that. And Vera?"
"Yeah?"
"I want you to know that I love you. I know you know, but I want you to hear me say it. And I know you told me not to start apologizing, but I'm sorry I haven't told you that more often. You deserve to hear it, Vera. You deserve to hear it every day. And I'm going to start telling you that every morning."
"I love you, too," she said through her tears.
Foz nodded and Dell took back his phone.
"She's going to meet us at the hospital. I think maybe you better call her back and prepare her," Foz said.
"Yeah, I'm thinking the same thing," Dell said.
Dell looked to his right, to where Andrea Gonzalez stood talking with a group of men and women dressed in windbreakers.
"I'm going to let her explain what's going on to both of us. I got the Reader's Digest version myself."
"How did you end up here?"
"We traced your phone, got the last known longitude and latitude. I thought maybe you'd gone back to Eduardo Lopez's apartment. By the time I got down here, SWAT was assembling in a parking lot just down the road. Apparently, they got a text that you were here."
"Detectives?" Gonzalez said. She looked to Foz inside the ambulance. "How are you feeling?"
"Like somebody stuffed me into one of those industrial-sized washing machines with a bag of rocks."
"You up to answering a couple of questions?"
"If you are," Foz said.
"You got some explaining to do."
Gonzalez smiled.
"Fair enough. How did you get here?"
Foz explained how he'd followed her and then followed Francisco to the storage facility.
"You're lucky they didn't kill you." "I talked a good game. I let them think I knew more than I did. I figured they were running drugs and suggested that whoever they were running them for wouldn't be happy with the attention killing a cop would generate.
I also told them Del would rain hell down on them.
Smart. I can tell you the cartel is really not going to like losing this much product.
So who are you? Foz asked.
I'm with the Organized Crime Drug Enforcement Task Forces. I've led a team pursuing this pipeline for more than 3 years. It's the largest distributor of heroin and meth on the West Coast. We have similar operations going down in every major city, including Vancouver, British Columbia.
And the guy I followed? The guy you met at the carnival, he's an informant?
Francisco Mercado. She shook her head. Mercado is a Sereno turned informant. 18 months ago, he had his second child, a boy. We busted him for dealing heroin just before his son's birth. Given the quantities he was dealing, and given that this was his third strike, he was looking at a potential life sentence.
He agreed to cooperate, Del said.
She smiled. Agreed is a little strong. He didn't have much choice. Mercado was the guy we needed to get inside and get details on the deliveries and shipments.
Is that why they moved you up here?
Gonzalez nodded. We finally had a viable informant.
You were his handler, Foz said, and our investigation into the death of Monique Rogers created a potential problem for you, Del said.
We needed a little more time to get everything set up and in place, Gonzalez said. Once Rogers got killed, we had to move up our operation.
What about Edward Lopez? Why was Mercado at the apartment that night?
Mercado let us know that little Jimmy put out a hit on you for $50,000 after you two went to his home and screwed up his party.
Gee, and I thought we were well behaved, Dale said to Foz.
Some people just don't appreciate us, Gonzalez said. When I found out you had a positive print on Lopez and were driving out to talk to him, I sent Mercado to the address to determine if Lopez was home, in case Lopez decided he was going to try to recover the $50,000 himself.
So why was Lopez next door? Foz asked.
I don't know, Gonzalez said. I suspect Lopez maybe thought Mercado was on his way to kill him. Word got out that you two had a positive print on the Rogers shooter and were moving to pick him up. Mercado said he'd heard it on the street. Lopez lived in the apartment so he could keep an eye on the storage facility for little Jimmy's crew. From what I've been able to piece together, Lopez must have seen Mercado pull into the parking lot and figured he was coming to kill him.
He went to the neighbor's apartment to hide, Foz said.
Gonzalez nodded. When Lopez didn't answer his door, Mercado figured he wasn't home and it was okay to knock on the door. That was the text he sent me that afternoon, the one I got in the car just as we arrived. Mercado didn't know Lopez was next door. Neither did I.
So when Lopez came out, you thought he was coming to kill me? Foz said.
I saw something silver in his hand and thought it was a gun. I wasn't happy about killing him for a lot of reasons. I wasn't happy when I learned it was a cell phone. I would have liked to have taken him alive.
So why did you tell the FIT investigators I was the one to yell gun?
I needed to get you off the street until we could take down little Jimmy. I didn't realize you were such a stubborn son of a bitch. Foz scratched at the back of his head and felt dried blood. It was rare that he and Del didn't figure things out, but they'd both been dead wrong about Gonzalez.
I guess I owe you an apology and a thank you.
Thank Mercado. He's the one who sent the text that you were here.
What'll happen to him?
We'll arrest him and make him go through the process, like he's going to do time with the rest of them.
Little Jimmy saw the photos I took of you talking with Mercado. He might already be burned.
Gonzalez gave this some thought. Then we'll assign him to witness protection, and he and his family will have an opportunity to disappear. If he keeps his nose clean, he'll be out. He's got kids now. Maybe that will be enough. Can I ask you a question? Are you always this dogged?
He's stubborn, Del said.
It's the Italian in him.
Gonzalez shook her head. I'm sorry about what happened.
Don't start apologizing, Foz said, thinking of Vera. Like I'm not going to be okay.
Who knew you were a part of the task force?
Del asked Gonzalez. Your assistant chief of criminal investigations, Stephen Martinez, arranged to have me transferred into your unit. And your captain.
Why violent crimes? Why not narcotics?
Narcotics was too obvious. We needed to keep this quiet until we had everything in place. But then you two pulled the Roger shooting, and I suspected it could be a problem. I was originally slated for C-Team. They had a detective who was retiring, and it was a built-in excuse for me to just slide in. When Rogers got shot, I asked Martinez to ensure I got put on your team so I could keep an eye on the investigation and make sure it didn't screw up my bust.
Tracy didn't care for you too much, Dell said.
I think I blew her secret, Gonzalez said.
What secret?
Foz asked. He looked to Dell, who also looked like it was news to him. Gonzalez smiled.
You don't know?
Know what? Is she quitting?
She'll have to, for a while, Gonzalez said. She's pregnant.
No,
Foz said.
Seriously?
He turned to Dell.
Did you know?
I suspected, but I wasn't about to ask. My luck, she could just be putting on a few extra pounds since her marriage. You know how that is.
Yeah, I do, Foz said.
Damn, Tracy's pregnant.
I guess she was trying to keep that under wraps, Gonzalez said. In another month, she's not going to have that choice. The secret will be out. I just happen to know a pregnant lady when I see one.
You have kids?
Foz said.
Four. Wow,
Foz said.
No kidding?
I'll take that as a compliment, detective. What about you two? You got kids?
Not me, Dell said.
One,
Foz said. I thought you Italians always had big families.
My wife and I got a late start, Foz said. And then there were complications. She couldn't have any more children.
I'm sorry to hear that.
It was uterine cancer.
Foz shook his head.
He could feel his emotions leaking out.
We just found out she has breast cancer. We're going through that process now.
Gonzalez touched Foz's shoulder. It's going to be okay. They get better treating it every year, and she isn't alone. She has a lot of sisters. I'm one of them.
Yeah?
Gonzalez pointed to her breasts.
You didn't think these were real, did you?
No comment, Dell said.
They laughed. Then Gonzalez said, I had a double mastectomy 10 years ago. I figured I might as well get something positive out of it. My husband is happy.
Dell and Foz laughed, though neither said a word.
I'll give you my private number. If your wife needs someone to talk to as she's going through the process, if she has any questions, you have her call me.
Thanks. She'll appreciate that. She's not saying much about it to me.
Give her some time and some space. It's a pretty overwhelming experience.
Foz looked to Dell.
Speaking of Vera.
Yeah, we better get you to the hospital, Dell said. If you think I can rain down hell, you don't want to see Vera at work.
This actually might be a good thing, Foz said.
Gonzalez looked skeptical.
How hard did they hit you in the head?
Vera's a caregiver, Foz said. It's what makes her happy.
Gonzalez smiled.
Then she's going to be very happy when she gets a look at you.
59. Patrol cars awaited Tracy when she came out of the park, escorting Himani Mukherjee. Kins had been busy. Red and blue emergency lights spotted the side of the home and the trees behind it. Neighbors had come down their driveways to the street, noticeably concerned, though they could never have guessed what had transpired and what was about to at their neighbor's house. Tracy placed Himani Mukherjee in the back seat of one of those patrol cars, her hands cuffed behind her back. If Himani was embarrassed, she didn't show it. She held her chin high, defiant, her eyes directed at the seat in front of her. Kins had already placed Nikhil in the back of a separate car, his hands also cuffed. Nikhil, however, had his head down, avoiding the stares.
The father just got home, Kins said, nodding at the house. He's inside with Sam, the grandparents, and Anderson Cooper.
How's he doing?
He's shell-shocked. They all are. He's called an attorney, a friend, and he's supposedly on his way.
What did Nikhil tell you?
Tracy asked. Not much. It was pretty much a standoff. He had a knife to his throat. The younger brother talked him down.
He didn't say he killed Kavita?
Not in so many words, no.
Kins looked at Himani's profile in the back seat of the patrol car.
Why? What's she saying?
She says she killed Kavita, Tracy said, following Kins' gaze. She says she hit her with a rock.
There's no way she carried her to that hole in the ground.
I know, Tracy said. She's lying to protect him. She said she'd already lost a daughter and she wasn't about to lose a son.
Almost sounds rational, doesn't it?
Do you think she sent Nikhil to kill his sister? I don't know. They knew she was at the hotel, and they knew she'd come to the park, for what reason we may never know.
She can't protect him now, Kin said. Not completely, anyway.
And if she does, they'll both be tried for Kavita's death, unless one or both of them plea. The son might. But I don't see the mother taking a plea. Tracy looked at the house. I feel bad for the father and for Sam, for what they've suffered through and what they're going to suffer through. Kins shook his head.
I know the daughter's death hits close to home, Tracy, he said. You doing okay?
She thought of that horrific day in Cedar Grove, when Sarah's remains were finally found in a shallow grave. Tracy had wondered how she could continue living, what would drive her after she had learned the truth about her sister's 20-year disappearance. She didn't have an answer then, and didn't until that moment in the bathroom of their Redmond farmhouse, when she'd held the pregnancy stick and saw two irrefutable lines. Tracy touched her stomach.
Yeah, Tracy said. I'm okay.
Epilogue. Saturday, December 15th, 2018. The nurse handed Tracy her newborn baby girl, swaddled in a blanket, a pink beanie covering the crown of her head. Her face was ruby red and her eyes wide open, searching with an unfocused and slightly cross-eyed gaze.
You're sure that's normal? Dan said to the maternity nurse. The cross eyes?
Perfectly normal, the nurse said.
Will her eyes stay blue? He asked.
Not always, but given that her mom and dad both have light-colored eyes, I'd say it's a strong possibility.
And she's healthy? Everything is okay?
She's 8 pounds and 3 ounces, the nurse said, chuckling. She's definitely not malnourished. They'd induced labor when Tracy went a week past her due date. The nurse, having completed many of her tasks, grabbed towels and trays and said, I'll give you some time alone. You have guests in the waiting room. Tracy looked to Dan, then spoke to the nurse.
Give us a minute before sending them in, and thank you for everything.
The nurse smiled. You did all the work. I was just here for support. After the nurse departed and the door swung shut, Dan walked to the side of the bed, bent down and kissed Tracy.
So, how are you doing, Mom?
Tracy smiled through the tears trickling down her cheeks.
She's so perfect, isn't she? She's so innocent.
10 fingers, 10 toes, 2 ears, and a nose, Dan said. I wish our parents could be here to experience this. My mom would have adored her. Spoiled or rotten, but...
How do you feel?
Dan smiled. Like I just climbed Mount Rainier, and I'm standing at the top of the world watching the sun rise above the horizon, seeing that first light of a new day and a rainbow of colors, and it still wouldn't be nearly as beautiful as what I'm seeing in this room.
Don't get too mushy on me. My hormones are going crazy.
She started to cry again.
Hey, Dan whispered. It's all right. Look at what you just did.
What we did, Tracy said. She looked down at her daughter.
I just want to protect her, you know?
I never want her to fall and skin her knee, or have some boy break her heart. We have time before the boys start coming around, he said. And her mom does own a couple of weapons and is still one of the fastest guns in the West.
I can teach her to shoot, Tracy said, not having considered it before that moment. She can compete.
As I said, she has a little time before we put her in training, Dan said. Tracy smiled and looked up at him.
So, have you given it more thought?
You know I'd be perfectly happy if you wanted to name her Sarah.
I know.
Tracy said. They'd had that discussion one morning while lying in bed thinking up names.
A part of Tracy wanted to honor her sister and to remember Sarah in a special way, a way that brought a smile to Tracy's face instead of a profound sadness. But Tracy didn't want